In heaven, there will be no conflict. There will be no mischief. There will be no mistakes or misunderstandings. In heaven, we will always treat one another with perfect love. There will be no conflicts, divisions. Nobody will ignore anybody else. It's going to be heaven. But in what might be the greatest understatement in the universe, earth is not heaven. Here, we have to deal with all of those things. People make mistakes. Sometimes it's us that makes the mistakes. There are many misunderstandings, and so conflict occurs, and it occurs all across the board. Even people whom we hold very dear to us, at times we can sort of be at odds with them, and we see those relationships begin to break down. And as a world, a culture, we've come up with some really great ways to resolve our conflict. It is the standard operating procedure. If you and someone else, no matter who it is not getting along, and there's some rub there, some issue, here are a few things you probably ought to do based on what we are typically taught. The first thing is you must protect yourself at all costs. This is not about fixing it. It's about winning. So the first thing you want to do is make sure that you always keep the upper hand. If possible, and even if you have to shift a word around left or right, if a conflict cannot be rectified, be sure that when it's all over with, the other person gets the blame completely and totally. If you need to lash out a little bit, throw a few words around, use some extra volume, do so. Lashing out in anger shows how emotional you are about it and further shows that you're the one that wants to make it right. Number four, be sure and talk about them to whoever will listen. You need a grassroots support system for this conflict so that when it's over with, you get to win. So whoever will listen, you tell them about what's going on and be sure to tell your side of the story just beautifully. Rehearse it well. And then lastly, be sure to just completely ignore them until they feel terrible about themselves. Ignore them to induce this sense of shame that if you hadn't caused this conflict with me, we could be having conversation and enjoying one another, but I am not going to talk to you anymore until you apologize completely. Now, I hope that as you hear me say these words and you look at the list behind me, you think this is the most ridiculous, fruitless, ungodly, sinful behavior one person could possibly have with another person, and you'd be right. But it's also some pretty common stuff, isn't it? It's the way that we react when something's not quite right. As I said, it's not about fixing the relationship. It's about coming out ahead. If I was going to look to Jesus, I would open the Bible to Luke chapter 6, and I want you to do that for a few minutes tonight as well. The truth is, Jesus says, don't even behave this way with your worst enemy. This conduct would not even be justified if this was someone who was treating you in the worst possible way. We use phrases like that, like, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. And the interesting thing about that phrase is there is certain conduct that you really wouldn't do with your worst enemy, but sometimes we find ourselves doing it with our family members, our friends, even our brothers or sisters in Christ. Jesus said, I don't care who you're talking about, there is a way that my disciples behave. If you're in Luke, the sixth chapter, let's read verses 27 and 28. He's talking about the far end of the spectrum here, even an enemy. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Verse 35, love your enemies, do good, lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, you will be sons of the Most High. He himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. If someone is totally out to get you, we still would not behave in the way that you see described behind me. How much more so the regular daily conflicts and disagreements that we have with the people closest to us in this life? Do Do you want to learn a better way? Because this way ends up with some crazy things. I mean, this way ends up with destroyed families. It ends up splitting churches. It ends up with a left overhand. There is fighting, there is bickering, and there is a legacy of divisiveness that I don't want and you don't want either. So what we want to talk about tonight is a case study from the Old Testament that will introduce for us a better way. A really nice system of a small set of points. And while we're going through this tonight, I want you to be thinking about relationships right now, this very second in your life, where something has happened. There's some estranged situation between you and someone else, or some cross word has been said, and you're wondering, what's the best way to deal with this? Well, maybe there's a story from the Old Testament that can help. I'm thinking of two brothers. And they had interesting conflicts basically from the moment they were born, just a few seconds apart. There was prophecy concerning one of them serving the other. Their household was filled with about the most clear-cut partiality division you've ever seen in any household, and it set them against one another. They had grand arguments, so grand an argument that one of them had to pack up and leave town for 20 years lest the other brother murder him. That's serious business. And yet at the end of those 20 years, God said, go home. I want you to go home to your brother, and I want you to make it right. Do you know which family we're talking about? Jacob and Esau from Genesis 32. Would you go back there in your Old Testaments, please, to Genesis? Let's take a look briefly at a couple of things leading up to the story. Our lesson for our study would begin in Genesis chapter 31. In Genesis chapter 31, where he was told to go home. God told Jacob to go home in Genesis chapter 31 and verse 3. Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. That included Esau. Go home, find your brother, I'll be with you, let's make it right. Now, in case you're not altogether familiar with this story, let me share just a little bit of back reading so you can see how serious their situation was. Go back a little further to two stories. The first one is found in Genesis chapter 25. I would like to begin in verse 23. Genesis 25, 23. Hopefully, by the time we're done with these two readings, you'll think, you know, I've got issues with people in my life, but it's not that bad. So that we can come away thinking, if these things help these two guys, I am sure this plan can help me. Let's take a look at their story. I'm in Genesis 25. I'll begin in verse 23. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples will be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. So his name was called Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, verse 27, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now, Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field and was famished, and Esau said to Jacob, please, let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished. Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, first, sell me your birthright. Esau said, behold, I am going to or about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me? And Jacob said, verse 33, first swear to me. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now that's one of the two really familiar stories we know about those two brothers. This was the beginning stage of what ended up dividing them. Who had a right to this birthright? Now, as you read this story, which one of these two brothers is at fault? If we were going to assign a blame and decide who's innocent and who is guilty, which one is innocent and which one is guilty? The answer is, it's mixed up, isn't it? This isn't like this morning's lesson where we talked about here is one person who is sinning and here is an innocent person who wants to come help them and how will they react to that? This is more sort of everyday real life. Everybody's at fault here. Esau should not have sold his birthright. That was a huge mistake. Jacob should not have offered the deal and made him swear to it. That also was a mistake. But they're not even the only ones to blame. Sometimes you can blame other people surrounding the issue, like mom and dad. Let's move forward a little bit in the story. I'm in Genesis chapter 27. We've got all kinds of things going. There's a prophecy that one brother would serve the other. There's partiality, fathers and mothers to sons, and there's problems. And in chapter 27 in verse 15, then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her elder son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the young goats on his hands, on the smooth part of his neck. She also gave the savory food and the bread which she had made to her son Jacob. Then he came to his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am." "Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, verse 19, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Get up, please sit and eat my game that you may bless me." Verse 30. Now it came about as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had hardly gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came in from the hunting. And you remember what happened. It's a really sad story of coming in and expecting the blessings. And so when we get to verse 41, Esau bore a grudge. That's a real conflict. "You have stolen everything I have a right to. Yes, I gave it to you, but I didn't really mean it." There are issues all over this story. So he bears a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing, verse 41, with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." That's serious business. I hope that that's a worse conflict than anything you're dealing with. Who's at fault? Boy, the blame tree just really sprouts out here, right? Seems like mom ought to accept some of the blame, don't you think? Rebekah helped her son lie to her husband. And Esau is still under the covenant that he made. And so this is still Esau's fault in part. Or maybe it's Isaac's fault for being so partial and causing Jacob to feel such jealousy for a relationship with his father. The truth is, it just depends who you ask. Does that sound familiar? Seems like every issue I'm in with other people in my life that's serious, that kind of goes on, it just depends who you ask. If you ask them, it's me. If you ask me, it's them. Once we finally get together, we usually get together because we decided to put all the blame on somebody else. But somebody's got to carry the weight. In this case, there was room to go around. But then we get to our text where God said, "Go home and make it right." Here's what I want to show you for the next few minutes. Easy short study tonight. I want to show you five very specific, just sequential things that Jacob did after 20 years. Remember, death threats and 20 years. That's a bigger deal than what we're dealing with here. After all of that, he put five ideas into practice. And here's the thing. It doesn't matter what the outcome is. He did what was right, and that's the main thing. But this story just also happens to have a great outcome. Here's the first thing I want to suggest to you. Go to Genesis chapter 32. That's where we'll be for the remainder of our study. Sort of a walk through some of what happens in Genesis chapter 32 and 33. Let's begin with this. God told him to go home. And verses 1 and 2. "Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. Jacob said when he saw them, 'This is God's camp.' So he named that place Mahanaim." That's the first thing I want you to see here. I love this statement. He has not interacted with Esau yet. He hasn't even done anything preliminary to set up his interaction with Esau yet and fixing their relationship. But before the other person is really even in the picture, "This is God's camp." That's a powerful idea. Do you remember when Jacob was leaving town? He was about in this same area and he had the ladder dream. The idea, not really a dream, but more of just a revelation of angels coming down Jacob's ladder. And he realized, "I am not alone. God is here." And now on the way back, angels appear to him and he says it again. "This is God's camp. God is here." And he even named that camp Mahanaim. Do you have any little superscript numbers or something there in your margin? Kind of depends on the Bible you brought with you tonight. But maybe you can look over in the margin and see the definition of that Hebrew word. Do you see it? What is it? Two camps. Wherever I go, there are two camps. And it's not me and my adversary. It's not me and Esau. It's God and me. Wherever I am, God is. It is always God's presence that makes this work. This is a powerful starting idea when it comes to fixing relationships with other people. This is God's camp. Wherever you go, however you speak to them, however you go about making it right, do you recognize that God is always there? God is listening on the phone line. Every time we talk to someone, and every time we talk about someone to someone else. God is with us when we are conversing with other people. When we choose to go and make it right, or we choose to segregate and separate and shame, God is there. There are two camps wherever you go, but there's some strength in that. Back just a moment and remember in chapter 31 and verse 3, when God said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, what did he say at the end of that verse? I will be with you. This is my camp too. And I'm just convinced that many relationships, maybe all of them, maybe every single one of them, that are strained would be repaired almost instantly if everybody here acknowledged that God is always in the room. God is always with us. He may not be in your camp, but He's always at the camp. Hopefully we can proceed as if God is our partner. He is our leader. He is with us always. So that's the first thing I want you to see, because it comes in before even having conversations with them. But then He does something else, something more practical. Look back in Genesis chapter 32 and let me read verses 3 through 5. Okay, God is with me, God is watching, God is helping, His strength is my strength. Now here's my first actual task to fulfill. Genesis 32 and verse 3. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau. Verse 4. He also commanded them, saying, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight. The second thing that he does is he uses the icebreaker. Don't go in cold. Sometimes we've got these issues with somebody and we're all charged up and we're just going to go in and say, let's just make this right. And nobody's leaving until one of us gets knocked out or we get this right. And you wake up an hour later. Two people are at odds. I think one of the wisest moves that Jacob made is he found somebody he trusted, these messengers. And he sent them out ahead to just let his brother know, I'm coming. I've been gone. I've been with Laban for these 20 years. Things have happened, and all I want, look at verse 5. I want to find favor in your sight. What's he telling him? I want to resolve this. He doesn't come out and say, I'm guilty and you're innocent. That's not altogether true. There's guilt all over the place. But what he does state is his intention. My intention is, I think we can make this right. And I hope you've utilized this before. I think there's a lot of power in using mediators. Someone who can be a messenger, someone who can be an assistant, someone that you trust, someone who knows you and they know the other person. If it's somebody you work with, there's another coworker that you trust that knows you and knows the other person. If it's your family, there's a family member that loves you and they love the other person. If it's a brother or sister in Christ, there's a shepherd at that church who oversees your future and theirs. There's some messenger, some mediator who can go on your behalf and say, look, I talked to Chris the other day, and he just wants to meet with you. I'm telling you, all he wants to do is make this right. And they're going to say, no, not Chris. I know him. He doesn't want to make this right. No, I'm serious. He really, really wants to make this right. Would you mind if we sit down and talk about this and just see if we can make progress? I don't know if you've gone that route before, but I've seen it succeed time and time again. to use someone that both trust and just go in. In this case, it's just these messengers who don't know Esau, but they go on behalf of Jacob and they just state this. Now, I don't know about the response that he gets in verse 6. It's a little scary. You see, Jacob doesn't know how that's going to go. I can think of a couple of times in my life when I wanted a relationship to improve and I sort of sent in a messenger and I was just sort of sitting on pins and needles as to how they're going to come back. And I have to say that so far in my life, they've never come back and said, well, he said he's coming to meet you and he's bringing 400 men with him. Whoa. That sounds a little scary. And the truth is, in verse 6, it's kind of ambiguous. I don't know if it's 400 men so they can give me 401 hugs and welcome me there and help me carry my stuff. Or if coming over the hill, verse 6, is going to be 400 men with armory and archery and swords to end my life. I don't know. It doesn't tell you how it's going to work out. But I think there's a lot of power in using related relationships and people that you trust. Now, they may say, you should have, remember our number one deflection this morning in our top 10 one-liners, they may say, you should have come by yourself. You shouldn't have sent a messenger. Well, if you'd have come by yourself, they'd have said you should have sent a messenger. Sometimes the heart of the other person isn't right. But I hope you understand that conflict resolution is much like the passage in Romans that says, as far as it depends on you, seek peace with all men. It doesn't mean there will always be peace with all men, but it means that there are the right way to approach situations to perhaps create the best possible result. And in this case, you break the ice, you send good intentions, you see if they can set up a meeting. Now, that's getting close here at this point. You now have the messengers who come back and say, look, we met with them. They didn't kill us. Here we are. There's 400 people coming. Can't tell you much about that, but this is about to happen. So what does Jacob do next? Go back to our text in Genesis chapter 32 and let me read verses 9 through 12. I forget, whose camp is it? God's camp, right? It's not just Jacob's camp and Esau's camp and the two camps are going to come together and we'll see if fire gets made. This is God's camp. So what do you think he's going to do? He's going to talk to God. What a great prayer in Genesis chapter 32 and verses 9 through 12. Let's go through this together. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. Now, there are at least three things going on in this prayer. Sometimes we say things like, I'm going to pray about that. I've got a big meeting tomorrow, and I'm actually going to sit down with this person, and boy, we've really been at odds. And it just seems like it's never come together, and we're finally going to sit down. I think I'll pray about that. Great, but what are you going to pray about? What will you say? I want you to note a few really great things from this short prayer. Did you see how he began the prayer and ended it? By vocalizing the promises of God. God, you promised to be with me. In fact, you have promised to protect me. You promised my grandfather and my father and me that our nation would be numerous. God, I am scared. I don't know what will happen, and I cannot control what other people do, but I'll tell you this, this is your camp, and I believe in you. One of the great things we need to do is think about the great things God has promised you. God has promised to look after you. God has promised to put a support system in your life among his people. God has promised that the blood and mercy of Jesus will follow you wherever you go. No matter how that meeting goes tomorrow, no matter what comes out of your effort, the promises of God never change. God's people use that for courage. The second thing that he does, verse 10, is acknowledge how unworthy he is of the blessings of God. I am unworthy of all your loving kindness. God, you've done so much for me. You have brought me through so many things. There were all these issues where I didn't know how I was going to make it, and you brought me through that whole deal with Laban for 20 years. What a mess that was, and you brought me through. God, you brought me this far. I think you can get me through this next conversation. I think you can help me do that. Sometimes when we reach conflict and we're going to have conversations and meet with people in ways that make us nervous, we forget how many of those conversations God has already brought us through. Jacob said, I believe in your promises, and I know you brought me through. And then finally, he was specific about what he really had on his heart. He said again in verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him. God, I'm going to talk to this person. I'm finally going to make that phone call. I'm about to handwrite this letter. God, help me with this. Help their heart, help mine. Let your will be done. He prayed, but he didn't just pray. He poured out everything that was on his heart about who God is, what God has done for him, and what he needs God to do tomorrow. And he found great strength with that. The third thing is pray and pray courageously. This is God's camp, after all. And then comes number four. You know, he's kind of using sort of spiritual approaches, number one, and then something kind of practical, number two, like send some messengers. Now he's back to really a spiritual exercise like prayer. And then when you get to number four, he goes back to something a little bit practical. Go back to the text and let me show you what he does next. Chapter 32 of Genesis, and I'll read verses 13 through 16. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. This is a real present. Check this out. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between the droves. Verse 19. Then he commanded also the second drove and the third, verse 19, and all those who followed the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and this is what you shall say, verse 20, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterwards I will see his face, perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent that night in the camp. Hey, don't overlook this. This is a pretty powerful tool. I don't know how many goats you have. But one thing that I noticed that he did is he selected something special to him, a present. And he sent that gift to Esau. It was a sign, right? It's not really about the animals. It's about saying, look, I want to take something of mine and I just want to give it to you. I want to give you a present. This is a sign of good faith. It's an indication of intention. It's another way of breaking the ice. Point number two breaks the ice. You send somebody in to see if they can get some conversations going. And here you send a gift. And what it does is it kind of diffuses the situation a little bit. It shows that my intentions are good and I really do want to have a conversation. Now I have to say, I realize I'm setting myself up here. I haven't been here long and I don't know if I'm in conflict with anybody. But if I show up to work tomorrow and there's a banana pudding on my desk, I know a conversation's coming. But I have to say, don't overlook something simple like this. Somebody you know, you had some issues with them. Let's say it's somebody at work, and I mean, it's just not gone right. Nothing seems to work. And you really want to give it another go, and you've been talking to God about it. You know what you might want to do? Go get you that little three-pack of Starbucks gift cards if you're in Tyler. If you're out here, get a Petty's card. Three of them. Just go by their desk and put it there and say, just thinking about you. Now, what are they going to think the first time? Gimmick, rubbing it in, all those negative thoughts. But then a couple days later when there's another one, you're like, that wasn't enough. I want you to have another cup. Or in the third one, you say, look, this time I want to have a cup of coffee with you. At some point, they have to acknowledge, and I don't care how mad at you they are, they have to acknowledge, I think he actually might be trying to be nice to me. I think that it's genuine. I think it's for real. And we're not talking about breaking the bank. We're just talking about doing something, giving something. Jacob had been greatly blessed, and that was going to be a principal sort of centerpiece of their conversation when they finally talked. Jacob's going to say, God has given me all this stuff. I want to give it to you. And Esau's going to say, no. God's given me a bunch of stuff, and I want to give it to you. I just kind of let the cat out of the bag. This thing ends really well. But what I really want to do is just kind of share something. I want to share with you. I want to take what I have and I want to share with you so that I can still have things, but I can also have a relationship with you as well. So I would say don't overlook this. It may be just a card that you send. It may be some nice gesture. But it's something that says, I was thinking about you. Number four, he selected droves of presents. And he sent them repeatedly, and then he came in behind that. Now listen, if Esau's heart is dark, Esau will slay all those creatures and slay Jacob when he gets there. But this is not really about the outcome. I think my life changed a lot in terms of relationship repair when I started recognizing that I'm not responsible for the outcome. I'm responsible for the process, for announcing that I'm in God's camp, for getting people to help me make things better, for praying about it, and for going out of my way to show love for others. That's my job. And God handles the rest. And that brings us to our fifth and final observation. Let's go to Genesis chapter 33, please, verses 1 through 3. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and, yes, 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. And he put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. We could talk about that in another sermon. Sometimes what you learn from your parents lives on. Verse 3, but he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. Stop there. Can you see that? I want you to see it. Esau is standing here. He's very hairy. And he has 400, that's a lot of people, 400 men with him, intentions unknown. And he's marching his way to someone whom he hasn't seen in 20 years. And the last time he saw him, he wanted to kill him. He still stole the birthright, never gave it back, couldn't give it back. Once it was given, it was done. And before he sees Jacob, he gets this drove of animals and then another drove. Well, remember, first messengers came and said he's coming. Then you get this, and then this, and then this. And then here comes Jacob, like this. No. Here comes Jacob. He stops. He's way down there, about 200 yards. And he bows down. And he gets up, and he travels another 20 or 30 yards, and he bows down. And again, he bows down, and he bows down again, and he bows again. And seven times, right up to Esau's feet, he bows down. This is not so much an admission that I have been totally wrong and you have been totally right. That's not really what this story is about. There's blame all over the place in this story. It's a humble and soft heart that's willing to approach this with great humility. More humble than even you think you ought to be. Just because you want this to work out. Can I tell you, that's the way God's people behave. That's always been the way God's people behave. And when Jesus taught the truth in the Sermon on the Mount, he built this same model. And so he's using this humble posture, this humble tone, and it triggers compassion. Let's not blow it, you know. We've prayed about it. We've announced God. We've got some people who've set up a conversation. We gave them something nice, a nice card or something. And then we walk in and say, all right, I've done a lot of good things. Are you willing to acknowledge how wrong you are? And we just ruin the entire process. Finish strong. You know how you finish strong? With meekness, strength under control. He was humble. His tone was humble, and he approached him. We can do this because we want the relationship to be repaired, not because the other person is completely right. What was the response? Let's read a little bit. In Genesis chapter 33 and verse 4, then Esau ran to meet him. Jacob's heart's going, I mean, he's running now with 400 men behind him. And embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. He lifted his eyes, and he saw the women and the children, and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Do you hear that humble language still? Your servant. Then the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterwards, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. Why are you sending me all these gifts? I want it to be right again. God told me to make this right. I wanted it to be right again. Esau said, brother, I have plenty. Let what you have be your own. Jacob said, no, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. That is an amazing phrase. I can't even explain what that phrase means. It's beyond me. But it's like if you were finally going to meet God and you're kind of frightened and it's a momentous, life-changing culmination moment and you see the face of God and He smiles at you. And every part of your skin is just absolutely tingling with unbelievable glee. He said, it's like I'm looking at the face of God right now. I didn't know how you'd respond. I didn't know what would happen. And you're smiling and you're embracing me. And this is what it was all about. They go back home eventually together, bury their father together, and they live in unison. This is how He did it. Your situation will not be exactly the same as this situation. Undoubtedly so. We live under a different covenant. We live under the law of Jesus. But this isn't about covenant law. This is just about humble, godly, well-intentioned behavior. But let's listen to Jesus as we close. Go back to Matthew chapter 5. It turns out that while Jesus didn't give us this exact 5-point sermon on how to make things better, He certainly talked about the heart of people who have strong and growing relationships. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21. If you're in our Wednesday night study in the Sermon on the Mount, this is that section on being righteous. And He really talks about the heart of the matter, gets to the heart of the matter. In verses 21 and following. You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you. We talked about this in class. It's not even that you have something against them. It's not even that they've done something wrong. It's you recognize that a brother has something against you. Leave your offering there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Be reconciled to your brother. How? Maybe Jacob's faith will give us some help. Be reconciled to your brother, to your sister, to your friend, to your husband, to your wife, to your neighbor. Even as so it depends on you, your enemy. As we offer the invitation tonight, I doubt this front row will fill up with people who are at odds with other people and want to come tell us all about that. You probably shouldn't do that. The best way to use the material from Genesis chapter 32 and 33 is to start something when you leave here. This is God's camp as your first wording, your first proclamation. See what you can do. But I will say this, if you want some practice on making relationships better when they're broken, why don't you start with God? If you're at odds with Him, if there's some conflict because of something in you, something you've done, we know it's not His fault. God is great. But there's some separation, something there. Tonight you can announce that it is His camp in which you live. His promises sustain you. And you can give Him the greatest gift of all, the droves of gifts that is you. Your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength, your body. God will receive you, and the relationship will be repaired, and the price of its breakage and repair paid by the blood of Jesus. If we can help you do that, come now as we stand and sing.